despair that it demanded a person with Reagan's extraordinary optimism about America to lead us back on the path to greatness, from rebuilding the military and the economy to restoring a sense of hope and national pride. Reagan believed in America's greatness because of his innate faith that any people would flourish when unshackled by the burdens of government. Today, the primary threat to our security and freedom is from terrorists and their state sponsors. They have made evil in the world increasingly difficult to ignore. But once again, the left-wing establishment in this country is back to doing what it does best, blaming America. They're attempting to shift the focus away from the malfeasance of foreign leaders and toward America's own supposed moral lapses, Jimmy Carter style. By the late 1970s, it seemed as if America, dragged down by its top-down malaise, was no longer equipped to stand up to a totalitarian system that did not have to answer to its subjugated people. The godless Soviet regime continued to offer itself as the model of a benevolent governmental system that could deliver people worldwide from the excesses and inequities of capitalism. Shamelessly ignoring the poverty of its own citizens, it focused its full energy against the West. At the same time, America was hardly in a position to be making official moral arguments against the secular Soviet system when it had begun consciously to divorce God from its own public square through a series of Supreme Court decisions mandating a, quote, wall of separation between church and state. No longer was it fashionable in our culture or in our court system to assert that our rights had derived from God. The conventional wisdom of the day, persisting into the present, was that government was the creator of our liberties. Our growing secularism thus reduced the great debate between the two countries to the question of which system could best provide for its people. Having undermined our own moral vision, we seem to be losing our ability to make official moral arguments against secular socialism. But at the same time, Americans were beginning to awaken to the idea that something had gone terribly wrong, that the radical cultural rebellion of the 1960s and 1970s was leading to America's demise. Not everyone in this country shared the left's lack of moral vision. Ronald Reagan saw the free world's conflict with communism in moral terms. When most of those around him wanted to believe that Soviet communism and the Western democracies could coexist in peace, Reagan saw confrontation as inevitable, morally as well as historically. As he would later confirm in his autobiography, Reagan felt that our policy of détente toward the USSR was a license for the Soviets, under the cover of apparent peace and goodwill, to pursue policies of subversion, aggression, and expansionism anywhere in the world. The consistent purpose of the Soviet communist regime, according to Reagan, was to destroy democracy and impose communism throughout the world. As history has proven, Reagan's view of the Soviets was realistic, but at the time it was dismissed with contempt by his liberal detractors, who saw Reagan and his brand of anti-communism as, quote, extremist at best, McCarthyite or even fascist at worst. Jimmy Carter had a very different view of America. The Soviet Union and their relative places in the world, he paid lip service to the notion that the President of the United States had a duty to restore, quote, moral authority to America's international policies without recognizing that moral authority might involve any attempt to curb the brutality and repression of the Soviet system. His naive approach apparently was to ignore the hostile nature of aggressor nations and attempt to tame them with loving kindness. The critical difference between Carter and his successor, Ronald Reagan, was that Reagan knew the words must be backed up by wisdom, by a sure knowledge of when it is time to act. Even the liberal Washington Post acknowledged during the 1980 election that Carter's inability to turn his beliefs into consistent policy had become a campaign issue. Carter's failure to act with conviction, coupled with his liberal view of the world, helped create a geopolitical mess that Ronald Reagan would spend much of the 1980s trying to correct. President Reagan recognized that communism had an insidious power, using its egalitarian message as a seductive trap. But once the trap was shut, swallowing some new communist satellite, the Soviets saw to it that it never opened again. From the Warsaw Pact forward, once they achieved control over a country, they had no intention of letting go, even if it meant crushing popular uprisings. The sovereignty of each country within the Soviet orbit was subordinate to the interests of the world of socialism, the world revolutionary movement. It was not until the advent of Ronald Reagan that the world saw a convincing reversal of this process. Reagan was a man of faith. He believed in the ideal of a free nation, full of industrious people who, with their own hands and hearts, could create a full life for themselves and their families. By its very nature, communism represented everything that Reagan hated: tyranny, brutality, aggression, and a godless view of the world that allowed it to justify virtually any act, no matter how ruthless and inhumane, to achieve its ends. In the realm of foreign policy, Reagan would meet Soviet leader Brezhnev's aggression with what columnist Charles Krauthammer called the Reagan Doctrine. Whenever possible, Reagan resolved America would support counter-revolutions and insurgencies to undermine and defeat communist expansionism. It would work to support the cause of freedom for oppressed peoples around the world, and it would take as its goal not the simple containment of the Soviet Union, but what Reagan saw as its inevitable defeat. The Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in December 1979 took already high tensions to a new level. Using more aggressive tactics than usual, the Red Army entered the country with two airborne divisions, seizing Kabul and following up with a massive influx of regular troops. Jimmy Carter was in shock. Quote, "The action of the Soviets," he told ABC News, "has made a more dramatic change in my own opinion of what the Soviets' ultimate goals are than anything they've done in the previous time I've been in office." Well, a comment like this, coming from an American leader 3 years into his presidency, was almost as shocking as the invasion itself. During his own time in office, Carter had seen a million people die at the hands of Cambodian communists. Before that, the world had witnessed the slaughters in Vietnam, Korea, and Red China. Certainly, he would have known of Stalin's mass murders, of Alexander Solzhenitsyn's personal account of Soviet concentration camps. Carter knew that the Soviet Union had moved into Hungary and Czechoslovakia to crush citizen freedom fighters, and he knew that desperate East Germans were regularly shot on sight simply for trying to escape communist tyranny over the Berlin Wall. The evil of communism was no secret. Jimmy Carter is not a stupid man, and the only conclusion we can draw is that he was willfully blind to the Soviet leadership's horrific history of violence. By the end of his presidency, aided by an increasingly liberal Congress, Carter had left America in a geopolitical mess, weakening her as an opponent of communism and international terrorism. In 1979, the year of the Russian invasion of Afghanistan, the United States suffered two other major blows in Iran and Nicaragua of large and strategic significance. In each country, the Carter administration not only failed to prevent the undesired outcome, but actively collaborated in the replacement of moderate autocrats friendly to American interests with less friendly autocrats of extremist persuasion. A few weeks before the 1980 election, the liberal Washington Post characterized the upcoming election as a contest between two men on opposite sides of the ongoing nuclear arms race, including the SALT II treaty negotiations with the Soviets. As usual, the Post was on the wrong side of history. As blind as Carter to the unrelenting evil intentions of the Soviets, they described Reagan's proposal to withdraw from SALT II because it was not directed clearly enough at actual arms reductions as, quote, an invitation to a renewed arms race. Their preferred approach? Appeasement. Reagan's speech at the 1980 Republican Convention presented a very different approach. It was a defining moment, not unlike the one George W. Bush faced after 9/11. After lambasting Carter's economic policies, Reagan denounced his rival's equally sorry foreign policy. Quote, "There may be a sailor at the helm of the ship of state, but the ship has no rudder." And he listed the growing number of concerns on the international horizon: the Soviet army training in Cuba and occupying Afghanistan, the pathetic contrast between American defense and the Soviets' growing military and nuclear might, our European allies' inability to rely on us for leadership to the Iranian hostage crisis. Carter's policies proceeded from weakness rather than strength, Reagan charged. His administration, quote, lives in the world of make-believe. We know only too well that war comes not when the forces of freedom are strong, he reminded his listeners, but when they are weak. It is then that tyrants are tempted. And while we should work in good faith with other nations to reduce international tensions, he said, America has an obligation not to, quote, let those who would destroy freedom dictate the future course of human life on this planet. Reagan pledged to commit America to regaining its position of strength toward fulfilling the goal of world peace. As early as the 1950s, Reagan had recognized that the Cold War was a battle of ideas, a test of wills. He understood what too few people really comprehend today, that the Cold War was a psychological struggle as much as anything else. By the time he reached the White House, though, the problem was clear. The Soviets were playing offense, America defense. We were responding to their moves. As any chess player knows, of course, and Russia was a nation of chess players, an offensive game always beats a defensive one. You cannot merely react as Carter did. You must confront and press forward where you can. The accepted status quo of containment and detente had to end. It is important to remember, as did Ronald Reagan, that throughout history, the world's greatest powers have rarely been conquered from outside without first collapsing from within. After the Vietnam Watergate era, and with a calamitous economy on its hands, America was facing a similar fate of losing faith in the future and losing the will to resist. But Reagan believed in American freedom and in the strength of the American people. He believed not only that we can turn things around, but that we might also have a unique chance to turn the tables on Soviet aggression. Ronald Reagan took the battle to the Soviets on two main fronts, by attacking their ideas and by demonstrating that the United States had the will to push back and hard. He accomplished this last goal by building up the military, by pressing for mutual elimination of nuclear arsenals, by confronting Soviet aggression in Afghanistan, Nicaragua, and elsewhere around the world, and by promoting innovative new technology to protect the nation from nuclear ballistic missiles. In his first year in office, to regain military and nuclear parity with the Soviets, Reagan set out to rebuild the military at a pace unparalleled in our peacetime history. He added army divisions and thousands of fighter aircraft for the Air Force and restored the Navy to nearly 600 ships strong. He resurrected B-1 bomber plans Jimmy Carter had canceled and went forward with the production of Trident submarines and stealth bombers. At the time, the voices of liberal opposition greeted Reagan's spending initiatives as economic suicide. Recalling the economic costs of Vietnam, they argued that America couldn't afford both guns and butter at the same time. As usual, the New York Times was among the first to pounce, attempting to taint the proposed buildup by suggesting that there was something sordid about the lucrative arms contracts the defense industry would garner as a result. The Times also warned of inflationary pressures that could rival those of the Vietnam period. Both criticisms were unwarranted. There was nothing sinister about the defense industry contracts, and the dire predictions about inflation never materialized. Still, the same old complaints have been dusted off by today's left with regard to President Bush's military buildup and action in Iraq. Some things just never seem to change. Reagan was as determined to push back Soviet gains in other nations as he was to rebuild the military, both strategies part of his larger goal of defeating Soviet communism. Reagan was especially focused on reversing communism's gains in the Western Hemisphere. In the early years of his presidency, Reagan joined conservatives in Congress in pressing for free elections in El Salvador and Nicaragua, and their success would have a profound effect on the credibility of the Soviet Union and on communism in general. Reagan's support for the Nicaraguan Contras would be among the most controversial aspects of his presidency, but it also revealed the stark contrast between his principles and the appeasement-minded tactics of the left. Liberals refused to accept Reagan's contention that a totalitarian socialist state was by definition evil and oppressive. A typical liberal argument in favor of the Marxist-Leninist Sandinistas, and I've heard them all during the 1980s, was that the Nicaraguan people were so poor and exploited that simply having food, a roof over their heads, and a regular job was all they could ask. It was the same liberal mentality that praised Cuban dictator Fidel Castro for his great strides in Cuban literacy without wondering what these literate communist children were being forced to read and how few opportunities they would have to exercise their knowledge, assuming we could even believe the propaganda about the literacy itself. What became known as the Reagan Doctrine took on many forms, not all of them military in nature, including quiet work with the Pope to support solidarity in Poland. But where the Soviets were flexing their own military muscle, as in Afghanistan, Reagan was vigilant about aiding the opposition. Support for the Mujahideen had been ongoing since the Carter era, but Reagan expanded U.S. covert assistance, supplying Afghan freedom fighters with Stinger missiles to defend against the firepower of the Soviet Hind attack helicopters. The Soviets would withdraw from Afghanistan just as Reagan was leaving office. In the battle of wills against communism, Reagan knew he'd have to contend with hostile forces other than the Soviets. But there was no more serious opposition to Reagan's plan to confront the Soviets than the nuclear freeze movement, which developed to stop the Western democracies in Europe from fortifying their nuclear arsenals to counteract the Soviet missiles aimed at them. Reagan supported an existing plan to place intermediate-range nuclear missiles in Europe. The nuclear freeze movement emerged to oppose the plan and gained substantial size and momentum as the democracies headed for their election cycles in 1982 and 1983. The Soviets were hoping to split the NATO alliance over this issue, and before long, battle lines were being drawn in what became one of the most dramatic standoffs in Cold War history, a fight for the hearts and minds of the people of the free world. The Allies' plan was simple enough, a two-track approach that would introduce these missiles while negotiating with the Soviets on an overall mutual reduction. But the leftists in Europe were already characterizing America as a bloodthirsty, militaristic nation, as Reagan later put it, and their propaganda was having an effect. The fate of Europe hanging in the balance, Europe was faced with a choice. Do we believe the nation that saved us from Nazi totalitarianism and then rebuilt Europe with the Marshall Plan, a free nation whose governing principles rest on a respect for individual rights, or do we put our faith in Soviet communism, which controls half of Europe against its will, tyrannizes the individual, and impoverishes its people? A growing chorus of voices on the left in Europe and at home sympathized with the forces of tyranny over those of Western freedom. What Reagan later called the Iron Triangle, the liberal special interest groups, mainstream media, and democratic politicians were all working in concert to thwart the progress of liberty. The Soviets played our left like a fiddle, accusing us of propaganda while distributing a 74-page paper to substantiate their claim that nuclear missile parity already existed, when in fact, the Soviets had a significant missile superiority. By 1983, there were six key European elections coming up. The freeze campaign was reaching near hysterical levels in Europe, culminating in demonstrations millions of people strong. Bleeding heart leaders of the movement did their best to ramp up the emotional, irrational appeal of the debate. "We're thinking of our babies," cried one such leader, Dr. Helen Caldicott. "There are no communist babies. There are no capitalist babies. A baby is a baby is a baby." Institutional forces across America jumped on the liberal bandwagon, from the American Catholic bishops to the leftist voices in Hollywood. The ABC television network jumped on the bandwagon by showing, quote, "The Day After," a made-for-TV movie depicting the horrors of a nuclear attack on America's heartland just days after a new supply of American cruise missiles arrived in Britain. And opposition found plenty of takers among the Washington appeasement lobby. Democratic House Speaker Thomas Tip O'Neill would call the freeze movement, quote, "one of the most remarkable political movements I have ever seen during my years in public service." Senator Ted Kennedy charged that, quote, "the arms race rushes ahead toward nuclear confrontation that could well mean the annihilation of the human race." As I pointed out before, other freeze supporters included Al Gore, Dick Gephardt, Chris Dodd, Joe Biden, Fritz Hollings, Madeleine Albright. Yesterday's freeze supporters are still today's Democratic Party. And Brezhnev capitalized on their, quote-unquote, useful opposition, accusing the United States of pushing the world into the flames of nuclear war. Well, thankfully, the nuclear freeze movement would fail. In November of 1983, conservatives Margaret Thatcher in Britain and Helmut Kohl in West Germany were reelected, and Europe began missile deployment soon thereafter. The Soviets walked away from the nuclear bargaining table, terrifying the freezniks, but Ronald Reagan told his aides they'd be back, and he knew why, largely because of an announcement he had made a few months earlier. In March of 1983, President Reagan delivered a speech that would change the course of history. In it, he asked, quote, "what if free people could live secure in the knowledge that their security did not rest upon the threat of instant U.S. retaliation to deter a Soviet attack, and that we could intercept and destroy strategic ballistic missiles before they reached our own soil or that of our allies?" It was the opening salvo in Reagan's drive to launch the Strategic Defense Initiative, known by the acronym SDI. The idea sent the Kremlin into a frenzy, afraid it would render their entire nuclear arsenal impotent and virtually neutralize their frantic military buildup of the preceding decade with all its crippling economic costs. As Policy Review noted a decade later, this marked the transition from the containment movement to the promise of propelling the world beyond communism and the Cold War. Many who witnessed these events at close range, including Margaret Thatcher, feel that Reagan's promotion of SDI was the beginning of the end of the Cold War and the Soviet Union itself. The battle over SDI was another important example of Reagan's strategy, longtime Reagan confidant and counselor Edwin Meese wrote years later. Reagan thought we should exploit our technological advantages here, not unilaterally restrain them as most liberals were recommending. He favored SDI on its own merits because he wanted to move away from a deterrence strategy that relied on nuclear weapons. He was also convinced that U.S. missile defenses would bankrupt the Soviet Union and force it to abandon the struggle. Liberals at home mocked SDI, derisively dubbing it Star Wars. Time magazine and most other elements of the liberal media adopted the moniker and scoffed at the idea that Reagan's plan was technologically feasible, a tack liberals have taken ever since. To them, SDI was nothing more than a hostile escalation of the arms race. But Reagan stuck to his hope for a better future, created by a new technology that would deliver the world from its long-held fear of nuclear weapons. And before long, Reagan's vision for SDI would bring the Soviets back to the negotiating table. The Soviets immediately recognized what a problem SDI posed for their negotiating posture. In November of 1985, Reagan and the new Soviet premier, Mikhail Gorbachev, held a three-day summit in Geneva. They announced an agreement in principle to a 50% reduction in nuclear warheads, but talks broke off when Reagan refused to bargain away SDI and left Gorbachev fuming about his intransigence. But Gorbachev faced even bigger problems at home. The USSR was in a state of internal and financial near collapse. The Washington Post had reported the Soviet officials were in despair over the nation's economy, convinced that America was trying to destroy the USSR through the arms buildup and Reagan's strategic defense program. It was against that backdrop that Gorbachev and Reagan returned to the bargaining table at Reykjavik, Iceland in 1986. By this time, the Soviets were approaching full panic mode. At the 27th Party Congress of the Soviet Communist Party, in March of that year, party leaders had announced that, quote, without an acceleration of the country's economic and social development, it will be impossible to maintain our position on the international scene. At Reykjavik, Gorbachev attempted to sandbag Reagan, offering to reduce his nuclear missile arsenal drastically, only to reveal at the final hour that his offer was conditional on the U.S. scrapping SDI. Like the American left, however, Gorbachev had greatly underestimated President Reagan. Upon hearing the demand, the president announced, quote, the meeting is over, let's go, we're leaving. Many would describe this as Reagan's finest hour. As Margaret Thatcher later observed, however, it was Reagan whose vision carried the day. 3 years later, she recalled in 1997, when Mr. Gorbachev peacefully allowed Eastern Europe to slide out of Soviet control, Ronald Reagan's earlier decision to stand firm was vindicated with Gorbachev's decision to release the Eastern Bloc satellites from Soviet control. And of course, as the Soviets embarked upon serious reform, the artificial construct of the USSR, sustained by lies and violence for more than a half a century, imploded with a whimper. It's important to understand that Reagan's battle of the wills with the Soviet Union wasn't just a matter of political gamesmanship. As early as his first press conference a few days after his inauguration, Reagan shocked the establishment by condemning the Soviet Union in purely ideological terms. He charged the Soviet leadership with having no moral core, with believing they had, quote, the right to commit any crime, to lie, to cheat, to achieve their goals. This kind of language may now seem familiar, but at the time it was unheard of, and it immediately changed the tone of the Cold War, putting the Soviets on the defensive. The most resounding blow Reagan dealt in the Battle of Ideas was the now famous Evil Empire Address, which he delivered in 1983 to the National Association of Evangelicals in Orlando, Florida. In that one speech, he articulated a set of priorities that still define conservatism today, denouncing the brutality of totalitarianism, embracing the role of God and faith in American life, and admonishing the liberal elite who had excused and coddled Soviet tyranny for decades. Perhaps most important, he stated flatly that his administration was guided by a basic recognition that America's greatness lay in her people, her families, her churches, her neighborhoods, her communities, the institutions that promote traditional, not secular values. Reagan went on to defend his contention that Soviet leaders were bent on world domination, subordinating everything else to that goal. Quote, during my first press conference as president, in answer to a direct question, I pointed out that as good Marxist-Leninists, the Soviet leaders have openly and publicly declared that the only morality they recognize is that which will further their cause, which is world revolution, Reagan said. I think I should point out, I was only quoting Lenin, their guiding spirit, who said in 1920 that they repudiate all morality that proceeds from supernatural ideas, that's their name for religion, or ideas that are outside class conceptions. Morality is entirely subordinate to the interests of class war, and everything is moral that is necessary for the annihilation of the old, exploiting social order, and for uniting the proletariat. As Reagan noted, the refusal of many influential people to accept this elementary fact of Soviet doctrine illustrates an historical reluctance to see totalitarian powers for what they are. We saw this phenomenon in the 1930s. We see it too often today. And with no apologies, Reagan went on to describe the struggle as spiritual in nature, demonstrating why he was the right man to lead America at that critical moment in history. Quote, while America's military strength is important, let me add here that I've always maintained that the struggle now going on in the world will never be decided by bombs or rockets, by armies or military might. The real crisis we face today is a spiritual one at root. It is a test of moral will and faith. Reagan's words had a profound impact around the world. Lech Walesa, the leader of the Solidarity movement in Poland, has said that that speech inspired him and undoubtedly millions of others. Even in the remote Soviet gulag, Jewish dissident Nathan Sharansky remembers fellow prisoners tapping on walls to communicate the American president's words. But leftist passions die hard. Even in the face of such an inevitable spectacle as the financial and geopolitical collapse of the Soviet Union, after the Evil Empire speech, New York Times columnist Anthony Lewis penned a typical liberal response denouncing President Reagan for invoking the ideas of sin and evil and claiming that God favors his programs. Lewis was particularly exercised that Reagan had used sectarian religiosity to sell his political programs. Primitive, he called the speech, with a sneering elitist arrogance. That's the only word for it. In the end, the Soviet Union fell not just because Ronald Reagan was a canny negotiator, but because he had the courage to stand on his convictions. Reagan and his message prevailed. Shortly after he left office, the Berlin Wall came down, and not long thereafter, the Soviet Union collapsed. And yet somehow, despite the evidence of history, American liberals have clung stubbornly to their warped view of international politics. They have never issued any mea culpas about their misreading of the Cold War, neither during Reagan's presidency nor in the 15 years since he left office. At the end of the 1980s, when Time magazine selected its man of the decade, it selected not Ronald Reagan, but Mikhail Gorbachev for the honor. To liberals, it wasn't Reagan's heroic call that brought down the wall in Berlin. It was the desperate capitulation of Gorbachev, the former KGB official backed against the wall by Reagan's principled defiance. But the real lesson for contemporary America can be found in the courageous example of President Reagan, who challenged the will of the aggressor and prevailed. The human capacity for evil is a frightening thing, whether it's Nazism, communism, or Saddam Hussein's personality cult. But appeasement of evil in its own way is equally frightening. Winston Churchill called World War II the unnecessary war because he witnessed the appeasement that caused it. He recognized that the largest and most destructive war in history could have been prevented if Britain's leaders had awakened sooner from what Churchill called their pacifist dream. Tragically, history repeated itself in the Middle East. The two wars that America fought with Iraq, not to mention Iraq's wars with Iran and Kuwait, all might have been avoided if Iran had remained what it was for over three decades, a powerful American ally. That's right, Iran was an ally right next door to Iraq. Now, I realize this might come as a surprise for many of my younger listeners, For the last quarter century, of course, Iran and Iraq have been vicious anti-American tyrannies. The two nations spent much of the 1980s at war with each other, and as liberal Democrats can't stop reminding us today, during that period, America supplied Iraq with arms. What you won't hear from these liberals, though, is that what paved the way for Saddam's rise to power and the Iran-Iraq war itself was the loss of Iran as an important American partner due to a disastrous miscalculation by a liberal American president. By the 1970s, Iraq was already a well-armed client state of the Soviet Empire. Iran, on the other hand, was our 800-pound gorilla, an oil-rich, pro-Western state with a large military and a modern air force. Along with Turkey, another American ally in the region, it was perfectly positioned as a buffer between the Soviets and the rest of the Middle East. But our alliance with Iran ended abruptly in January of 1979, and not because the Shah of Iran rejected us. It ended because America rejected him, despite the Shah's consistent loyalty and friendship to America. It was a loss that could probably have been avoided, but for the weakness and dangerous naivete of a single American president, one celebrated today, ironically, as a peacemaker, Jimmy Carter. Admittedly, as even conservative historians concede, the Shah wasn't a perfect ruler. In his attempts to rush his ancient Persian society into the modern world, he ruled Iran as an often oppressive regime. But our alliance with the Shah was strategically crucial, and his demise, facilitated by the reckless policies of Jimmy Carter, cleared the path for an extremely anti-American, authoritarian regime whose crimes far outstripped anything the Shah had done and ignited decades of renewed turmoil in the Persian Gulf. Within the context of the Persian Gulf, the Shah had actually been a moderate influence. But early in his administration, in a sanctimonious way, Jimmy Carter began pressuring the Iranian leader to stop holding military tribunals and to release certain political prisoners, some of whom were known terrorists, and try them in civilian courts. Well, the ensuing civilian trials became spectacles of anti-Shah propaganda, though he was nowhere near as radical as Islamic fundamentalist leaders generally were. Marxists and Islamists painted the Shah as an extremist ogre. Carter also strongly urged the Shah to permit free assembly, though under the circumstances that meant declaring open season for potential insurgents to meet and plot revolution. With Carter threatening to cut off military aid and training unless he did so, the Shah had little choice but to comply. His change in policy was interpreted as a weakness in his authority. Supported by Moscow, local dissidents exploited the situation to stir up further unrest. The streets of Tehran filled with demonstrations as angry college crowds and a Shiite clergy that resented the Shah's march to modernize conspired to further undermine his authority. With the Shah's government under assault, Carter offered no assistance. Indeed, he actually urged the Iranian not to defend himself. Not satisfied with his own efforts at appeasement, Carter was fond of lecturing other leaders with his self-righteous philosophy. Now he warned the Shah against using force to quell the opposition. In his autobiography, Ronald Reagan was blunt about Carter's treatment of the Shah. Quote, "Our government's decision to stand by piously while he was forced from office led to the establishment of a despotic regime in Tehran that was far more evil and far more tyrannical than the one it replaced. And as I was to learn through personal experience, it left a legacy of problems that would haunt our country for years to come." Though President Carter didn't seem to care, the Shah's Iran was not only a linchpin to the balance of power in the Middle East, it was also a key to our Cold War abilities. My Fox News colleague, retired Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, who was active in the service at the time, notes that the Shah's Iran was one of our key listening posts for monitoring Soviet space, missile, and nuclear warfighting programs. The Shah's eventual overthrow, directly due to Carter's policies of appeasement, created a leadership vacuum, a gap filled by the Ayatollah Khomeini, one of the most militant anti-American leaders in modern history, largely because Jimmy Carter could not see past his own inclination to moralize over the Shah's transgressions. Khomeini's regime, with no experience in government, would rule Iran with an iron fist, wielding its considerable military might against its own vulnerable minorities. The Islamic theocracy was brutally oppressive to members of the Shah's fallen government and army, but the regime was an equal opportunity oppressor, also murdering sympathizers of competing religious leaders and the disfavored minorities, executing more than 8,000 8,000 people who were summarily convicted as enemies of Allah in the regime's autocratic courts. In all, some 1,000 Kurds and 200 Turkmens were murdered, as well as Christians, Jews, and other minority sects. The regime also destroyed churches and other sacred properties of the minority religions. The repercussions of Carter's bungling persisted long after the man himself left the White House. In 1991, the Ayatollah's son declared that, quote, after the fall of Marxism, Islam replaced it, and as long as Islam exists, U.S. hostility exists, and as long as U.S. hostility exists, the struggle exists. Iran became what Washington Post columnist Charles Krauthammer would call the motherland of revolution, an orchestrator of disorder. What was once America's strongest ally in the Gulf had become the number one radical Islamic terrorist state in the world. At the end of the day, it is the trials such as these that we find the measure of our leaders, especially our presidents. When it comes to our national security, a president's war face, as General Patton put it, is all that matters. No president in this century had a less convincing war face than Jimmy Carter. Cloaking himself in the banners of peace and nonviolence, he proved unwilling to confront evil when circumstances required decisive action, and thousands of Iranians, among others, paid the price. To those who suffer under the despotism born of his appeasement, Carter's Nobel Peace Prize must seem a cruel joke. In recent months, liberals have delighted in pointing out that during the 1980s, the Reagan administration did business with Saddam Hussein's Iraq. Yet the truth is that during that period, the U.S. was forced to play the hand the Carter administration had dealt. It was Carter who left us without an ally in the newly unstable Persian Gulf, and it is his administration, not Reagan's, that should be blamed for leaving America no choice but to align ourselves with Iran's neighboring enemy in order to prevent Iran, a terrorist powerhouse, from winning the war. Indeed, it was the fall of the Shah in January of 1979 that directly precipitated the rise of Saddam Hussein. By June of that year, with the frightening Shiite Muslim uprising occurring right next door, Saddam, a Sunni Muslim by clan and a killer through and through, seized absolute power in Iraq. Saddam was tempted to invade Iran because its high-ranking military officers had been displaced in the revolution and its formerly powerful military was disorganized and weakened. But he underestimated Iran's resilience and its resolve. What he hoped would be an immediate rout was the beginning of an 8-year military marathon between the two countries, resulting in millions of deaths for both and very little territory exchanging hands. In the process, America joined other Western nations in providing aid to Iraq. Though aware of Saddam's brutality, the Reagan administration was anxious to bring stability to the region and chose what it perceived to be the lesser of two evil regimes. As we've noted, the appeasers usually fail to recognize the error of their judgments. Not only are they loath to apologize or answer for their miscalculations, they continue to preach from the same discredited script. In September 2002, as war with Saddam seemed increasingly likely and the President of the United States could have used the endorsement of former presidents, or at least silence from those who held differing opinions, Jimmy Carter went public with his criticism, writing in the Washington Post, once again, Carter tried to warn America away from war. The title of the piece, "The Troubling New Face of America," says it all. True to form, Carter pegged America, not Saddam Hussein, as the problem. Carter took what was quickly becoming a familiar liberal Democratic Party line, that conservatives are unilateralist warmongers who want to export democracy forcibly through military action. Other liberals have picked up on these themes, accusing President Bush and his neoconservative advisors and supporters of trying to build an American empire under the guise of fighting the war on terror. But Jimmy Carter and his fellow travelers, the appeasers, once again are sadly mistaken. In effect, they were arguing for withholding action against Saddam despite the fact that he had repeatedly defied United Nations resolutions. Would they have preferred to wait until Saddam was ready to threaten us with weapons of mass destruction or had procured them for the terrorists he supported and harbored? History suggests they would have, with disastrous results. Today's liberal elites are carrying on Jimmy Carter's ignoble tradition, as the debate over Iraq has proven. America's struggle with Saddam Hussein, which gave rise to two wars in 12 years, has been marked by the same cowardly behavior among Democrats and the media alike. Liberals, including those at the United Nations, knew well the crimes of this evil man, knew what his regime represented, and his potential danger to the civilized world, and still they hesitated to act. Even as the debate rages on about Saddam Hussein, you get the feeling that some people just don't get it. You see them on Hannity and Combs all the time. They'll call Saddam a bad guy, then without skipping a beat, explain that we should have waited. They know he developed and used chemical weapons against the Iranian army and against his own people, the Kurds in northern Iraq. But they're more interested in whether the president overstated the case against Saddam in a State of the Union address. The irony is, it won't be long before liberals claim that Hussein's fall was inevitable, just as they now seek to justify their wrongheadedness during the Cold War. But the Soviet Union didn't fall on its own, and neither would Saddam. The Hussein dynasty could have lasted into the foreseeable future. Saddam had two sons who helped him control the levers of terror, train killers like their father, who would carry on the reign of terror. And moreover, if Iraq had succeeded in purchasing just one crude nuclear device, Saddam would have wielded enormous power in the Middle East. He would have also posed an even greater threat to America, possessing both the ability and will to help terrorists unleash such a weapon against our country. No one would have dared invade Iraq under those circumstances, and certainly no revolution could have succeeded from within. Considering the UN's reluctance to deal with Saddam, and considering the many individual nations who were all too happy to do business with him, he could well have lasted long enough to develop his own substantial nuclear weapons program. Remember, Iraq is positioned right next to three of the world's richest oil nations. Once Saddam managed to obtain a nuclear device, how could he have been stopped from dominating Kuwait, Iran, Saudi Arabia? What could we have done if he had seized access to some 60% of the world's oil supply? Saddam and his sons would have had plenty of time to use their oil leverage to change hearts and minds in the UN and among his own neighboring countries, which might no longer look to the United States to protect them. Saddam's track record tells us that such a scenario is by no means far-fetched. The 1 million men who died in the Iran-Iraq war were only part of the larger portrait of death revealed when Iraq fell in 2003. Estimates range from hundreds of thousands to 1 million men, women, and children executed and buried in mass graves during Hussein's reign of terror. The unearthing of the bodies will no doubt continue for years. In 1990, Saddam invaded the tiny nation of Kuwait, the first step in his dream of building a new Babylonian empire. But what our enemies haven't seemed to figure out is that aggressive action against American interests is more dangerous when the American president is a Republican than during a Democratic administration. Thankfully, Democrats weren't in power when Saddam began his mischief in Kuwait. Ronald Reagan had passed the torch to George Herbert Walker Bush, who understood that a righteous nation like the United States had the right to wage war to protect our national security interests, to stop aggression, and to halt genocide. It's one of the great ironies of modern politics that the Democratic Party has somehow managed to preserve their image as the party of compassion and human rights when time after time they have refused to rise to the defense of victims of brutal despotism. During Iraq's siege of Kuwait, the exact numbers of rapes and murders were in dispute. Was it thousands, hundreds, scores? Hussein wouldn't allow anyone into Kuwait to verify the horror stories told by witnesses who escaped. Kuwaitis were suspected of exaggeration. Despite the urgency of the situation, liberals were frozen in indecision. The debate that followed found congressional Democrats urging the president to wait for sanctions to take effect. By now, of course, it's a familiar story. Liberals always prefer to dither in debate while the plundering proceeds. Quote, history shows that even brutal dictators have been toppled and defeated by sanctions, Majority Leader Dick Gephardt complained. Who knows how long that could have taken? How many more innocent Kuwaitis would have died before sanctions could even cause a dent in Saddam's oil-rich, ruthless regime? Democrats held on to their precious sanctions for dear life. By voting for this resolution, you are voting for a declaration of war. The American people don't want war, insisted Representative John Lewis, Democrat of Georgia. What is wrong with being patient? Patience is not appeasement. Patience is not a dirty and nasty concept. An amazing 179 House Democrats voted to wait to, quote, let the sanctions work. It was even worse in the Senate, where 82% of the Democratic senators wanted to wait, including our good friend Ted Kennedy. It's sad, Kennedy said, that the United States, with all our ideals and all our heritage and all our history, has now become the country driving the engine of war while other nations offer the olive branch of peace. America? Driving the engine of war? You talk about blaming America first. Saddam Hussein invades an innocent neighboring country, and somehow we're in the wrong? Well, excuse me for letting my face get in the way of your boot, Mr. Hussein. After U.S. troops entered the Persian Gulf to take on Iraq, the Johnny-come-lately Democrats, most of them anyway, joined House and Senate Republicans in a non-binding resolution commending President Bush and supporting the troops. According to Democrat Nancy Pelosi, there should be no doubt, she said, that although we have strong disagreement with the policy here, that there is no disagreement for our support and prayers for the troops and their families. Then, as now, of course, the Democrats were desperate to have it both ways, distancing themselves from the Gulf War, but still eager to be seen as, quote, supporting the troops. But when it comes to supporting the military, the Democrats just don't have much credibility. Since the disgraceful days of Vietnam, they have rarely missed an opportunity to cut funding, protest military action, and air their lack of faith in the American military's ability to get the job done. Anti-military Democrats clearly controlled and still control the party. Among the Democrats who voted against the Kuwait resolution in 1991, several currently hold top leadership positions in the Senate. Joseph Biden of Delaware is the ranking member of the Foreign Relations Committee. Carl Levin of Michigan, the ranking member of the Armed Services Committee. South Dakota's Tom Daschle, of course, is the Democratic leader. Vermont's Patrick Leahy is the ranking member on the Judiciary Committee. West Virginia's Robert Byrd, the ranking member of the Appropriations Committee, and West Virginia's Jay Rockefeller, the ranking member of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. Several current Democratic senators were in the House at the time of the 1991 vote, where they voted against the resolution. Barbara Boxer of California, Richard Durbin of Illinois, Charles Schumer of New York, Byron Dorgan of North Dakota, Ron Wyden of Oregon, and Tim Johnson of South Dakota. But the Democrats were wrong, of course. The ground war against the invading Iraqi army lasted only 100 hours. The total number of American soldiers lost in combat was limited to 148, and Kuwait was freed. And yet liberals remain unchastened by this latest victory they had refused to support. As soon as the dust had cleared in Kuwait, the Democratic Party changed the channel to "It's the economy, stupid," distracting America's attention from their determined and reckless appeasement. And it wouldn't be the last time. The more I experience being a parent, the more I understand why children like traditional fairy tales. Even as an adult, I love them. They may be stories, but they deal with the basic truths of life. Things like courage and fear, hope and despair, loyalty and betrayal. We adults aren't always so in touch with these truths. We're more likely to rationalize them away. We can turn a lie into an opinion, or cowardice into reasonable caution, or betrayal into the only sensible thing to do given the circumstances. Our vision seems to have been blurred by the pervasive cloudiness of morality in our culture. Children are just too innocent, they're too wise, not to size up any new situation they confront with complete honesty and candor. When my son is afraid of the dark, for example, or a thunderstorm, well, that's a meaningful emotion. There may be no immediate danger, but his basic impulse is right. The dark can hide things. With our vision dulled, we're right to take extra care and anticipate danger. Moreover, it's only through experiencing fear that we can learn to overcome it. In the meantime, until he's old enough to handle it himself, he knows he can always call in the big guns, mommy and daddy, to tuck him in, read him adventure stories full of inspiring ideals, courage, heroism, victory snatched from the jaws of defeat. Of course, great moments in history, like fairy tales, also have a way of distilling things down to their essence. While we're living these moments, we adults can't always appreciate them. It takes time and sometimes a different perspective to see them clearly. As we've seen, while Churchill, Reagan, and Bush shared a knack for perceiving and seizing pivotal moments in history, their respective liberal counterparts were wholly blind to those moments. The sad truth is such obliviousness has characterized the American left for years. From Carter's worthless dithering over Russia and Iran to Clinton's arm's-length approach to terrorism. In every case, they have been ardent appeasers, and in every case, they've been wrong. It's not just that liberals fail to see history in the making, they also ignore the lessons of history, even those that should be fresh in our minds. Why? Because their approach toward world events is based on ideology, not on logic, on politics, stalling, and hair splitting, not on moral judgment. No matter how much Saddam Hussein brutalized and murdered his own people, how many times he lied about his weapons of mass destruction programs, how many times he violated his Gulf War treaties and United Nations resolutions, liberals continue to treat him as an honest broker, insisting that he could be brought to heel if only he had been given more time. No matter how often the United Nations airs its intrinsic antagonism and hostility towards the United States, liberals defend its every self-important pronouncement, promoting it as the panacea for every international conflict. Sure, sometimes it seems that liberals are beginning to see the light, that they're finally getting it. After the 9/11 attacks, they were right there with us, apparently seeing evil as clearly as we did. But in no time, they were back to their old ways, wringing their hands over potential quagmires in Afghanistan and urging patience in Iraq. One reason for the Democrats' moral weaknesses is that they see every problem as a political problem. And throughout the last 2 years, and through a midterm election dominated by President Bush and the Republican Party, they've had to face a difficult truth. If you asked a Democrat what the problem was, he might say, oh, my party's got an image problem. We can't shake the idea that we're soft on defense. But in truth, though, the Democrats' problem goes far deeper than their image, down to the reality of who they are and how they would run the country. Their liberal track record just speaks for itself. So as the race for 2004 began shaping up, the Democrats were faced with a dilemma. How could they possibly convince the American people that they're worthy of our trust on national security at a time when that issue is sure to be more important than any other in the 2004 elections? They know they can't capture voters' trust by dismissing the threats to our national security. Nothing could be more politically suicidal. Yet they know they can't afford to alienate their leftist base, even if they wanted to, which is doubtful. So what to do? Well, Democrats are nothing if not resourceful. And it didn't take long for them to break out a favorite old strategy to deal with their image problem. They apparently view it as their best chance to shed their image of being soft on defense without actually having to grow a backbone. They call it multilateralism. I call it the new appeasement. As we'll see, the Democrats' big idea is to cultivate an image of sophistication in foreign policy by advocating that we work more closely with other nations to combat international terrorism. If we would only work through the United Nations, they claim, then we could have the cooperation of the entire world and everything would work out fine. Never mind that America has its own national security to worry about. Never mind that nations like France and Germany were courted tirelessly by the Bush administration, even when their demands flew in the face of America's interests. Never mind that our supposedly unilateral action in Iraq was actually mounted by a coalition of willing nations. The Democrats hope to get to the White House by calling George Bush a unilateralist. Well, I've got two problems with the idea. First of all, the fact that a few other recalcitrant nations won't agree to join your cause doesn't make you a unilateralist, even if those nations are longtime allies. But here's the more important point. Unilateralism is no crime. If it means acting in our own national security interests, regardless of the stance of other nations, it is our right. No, it's our duty to protect our own interests, regardless of whether other nations are willing to help us. We have never agreed to mortgage away our military to the UN or to delegate our national security interests to other nations or international bodies. And no matter what the Democrats might prefer, we must never do this, not if America is to remain an independent nation. You can dress it up in whatever colorful international garb you want, but the Democrats' multinationalism is still appeasement any way you cut it. You don't hear much about it today, but one of the most telling early terrorist challenges America has faced in the post-war era began back in the late 1970s when Libya's Muammar Gaddafi began a series of antagonistic incursions into international waters. After Reagan's Republican administration took over the White House in 1980, they moved swiftly and decisively to curb the activity. But the Democrats cried unilateralism, and the voice that was leading the attack was none other than Senator John Kerry, the 2004 presidential candidate and still one of the Senate's most vocal multilateralists. Kerry and his party were wrong 20 years ago, and they're just as wrong today, and they're wrong for all the same reasons. Within months after taking office, though, Ronald Reagan took a stand against Gaddafi's terrorist regime. He made it clear that American maneuvers in international waters off Libya would proceed as they always had before Carter, following universally accepted guidelines, no less, no more. Anticipating trouble, the Joint Chiefs of Staff asked President Reagan for clear rules of engagement. What should American pilots do if attacked? Did Reagan's standing orders allow for hot pursuit? Reagan's answer, all the way into the hangar. In March of 1986, armed with new weapon systems, Gaddafi declared the Gulf of Sidra a, quote, zone of death for American naval forces. The Libyans fired on American airmen, and our military action was swift. Gaddafi's forces took a beating. But this time, there was an immediate follow-up using terrorist tactics. On April 5th, a Berlin disco, popular with American servicemen, was bombed, killing one American sergeant and wounding 50 GIs. Civilians were also affected, including one Turkish woman who was killed. Well over 100 others were wounded. After intelligence confirmed that the attack was tied to Gaddafi, President Reagan responded immediately. He resolved to send U.S. F-111s from Britain over France and across the Mediterranean to deliver a surprise attack on Gaddafi's military headquarters and barracks in Tripoli. The attack was successful, but two Americans were lost, and some civilian lives were lost in Tripoli due to an errant missile. Nevertheless, Reagan's message was delivered. As he later reflected, as tragic the loss of life was, I don't think their lives